joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Rebels in Libya called for a ceasefire if certain conditions were met. The U.S. sent CIA operatives to that country. Defense Secretary Gates said putting U.S. troops on the ground was not an option. Syria's president spoke to the public for the first time since unrest began. He blamed the turmoil on foreign conspirators. And Japan found heightened levels of radiation in the sea near damaged nuclear reactors. Joining me in the studio for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, James Kitfield of National Journal, David Sanger of The New York Times. And don't forget, if you're not near a radio and you're in front of your computer, you can always stream the show live. So just go to drshow.org and hear all these good people and their thoughts and comments. If you'd like to join us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Dan.
David Ignatius, I know you've been traveling with Defense Secretary Gates. He testified before a congressional committee this week. He said, no boots on the ground, U.S. boots on the ground, while he's in office. But we already have CIA people there.
Well, when is a boot not a boot? I don't know whether CIA officers wear Gucci loafers, but I think Gates was talking about the thing that's concerned him most, which is uniform military involvement in this operation. He was a skeptic about the no-fly zone. He said publicly that you have to understand this is military invasion. This is an attack on Libya. I think he reluctantly came to support the policy. He told me when I was traveling with him that it was the decision of the Arab League to call for this that finally convinced him that it was genuinely multilateral. But Gates is now, in his testimony this week, trying to make sure that the limits on U.S. ground forces are understood and observed. I think his wariness is still very strong about this.
But, you know, I'm old enough to remember that this is precisely how Vietnam began, mm-hmm. with CIA involvement in that country, James Kitfield.
This thing was custom designed for mission creep, because you had a strategic goal, getting rid of Gaddafi, and you had military means that would not achieve that goal, which is a no-fly zone. So we've seen it already morph into a no-drive zone. We've seen it. We're getting very close to Allied air power as the air force for the Libyan rebels. And if that doesn't knock him out, then we'll have to figure out about arming and training the rebels. You're on one side of a civil war, whether you like it or not. That was the warning that people said going into this thing that concerned them. But we are in it, and you know, basically, as we look forward, you know, there have been some promising defections from Gaddafi's inner circle this week.
And even this morning, we've heard about more.
Right. His foreign minister and former foreign minister and UN ambassador have both defected. There have been reports that his sons have emissaries in Britain talking about a way out of this, a way that he might go into exile. He still hasn't, you know, tipped his hand about what he would accept. So this may come to a happy conclusion, and I think him leaving would be a happy conclusion for the people of Libya. But we shouldn't have any sort of doubts that we're in this thing, and we're not going to get out of it until he leaves.
David.
Well, you know, when Jim says this was custom designed for mission creep, I think he's exactly right, and it's for two reasons. The first is that the UN mission, of course, is simply to protect the population. Whereas the President of the United States stepped out more than a month ago and said Gaddafi has to go. And as much as the White House has tried to talk around that and square the circle and so forth, the fact of the matter is that if you've declared he has to go and yet your forces, as we heard again from Secretary Gates yesterday, are not there to oust him, you have a strange mix of your means and your declared goals. The second reason I think that mission creep is very possible here is that the incentives for Gaddafi to leave are really, really low. Now, you know, I'm the guy who a couple of days before Mubarak left said I didn't think he'd leave. So, you know, discount this for that. But if Gaddafi leaves, he faces the almost certainty of an international criminal court prosecution. His money has been cut off. All of the incentives are there for him to stay and fight it out to the end.
David Ignatius, how many CIA personnel are there and what are they doing?
I'm told, Diane, that the number is in dozens, not hundreds. They're doing a range of things. First, they're trying to get to know this opposition. One of the problems that the U.S. has had is that these rebels are really an unknown quantity for us. So they're making contact with them. In many cases, they're providing them with covert communications devices so they can be in touch with the outside. They're also, I think, working to identify the Libyan army's ammunition dumps, if it has chemical weapons supplies, find them, help with targeting by identifying and lasering potential targets. They're doing the things that paramilitary operators do on the ground. You can argue that this Libya situation is sort of what intelligence services are invented for. But I think the final thing that I'd say, which is a key part of this, and I would disagree a little bit with the idea that we simply have intervened on the side of the rebels. One thing that the U.S. is doing aggressively is contacting members of Gaddafi's regime. We've contacted his chief intelligence, Abdullah Senussi. There is one more member of the cabinet who I'm told has already agreed to defect. They're just waiting for the time and place. And also there are a range of people in Tripoli, professional people, doctors and lawyers, the kind of people that you'd want as part of a transition government who, because they're in Tripoli, seem to be part of the regime but really aren't, and we're trying to make contact with them. So it strikes me that although there was a big hubbub about, oh, my gosh, the CIA is involved, they're doing pretty much what you'd want to have happen now, which is reach out and find out who are these people? What do they want?
This is not entirely new territory for the CIA. Remember, it was 2003 when Libya gave up its nuclear weapons program, and had they not, this would be a very different situation today, because we'd have the doubt about whether that had been successful. But as a result of that, there was a lot of CIA interaction with the Libyan leadership during the period of time of the removal of the weapons and so forth. So it's not like they're dropping in to completely unknown territory.
And how much dissension is there among NATO members about who's going to do what and who takes the lead, James?
Well, NATO took the lead this yesterday, as a matter of fact. And, you know, I've been shocked at how they've gotten over their dissension. Actually, I thought that after Afghanistan, which was their signature out-of-area operation, if you will, that they would be very, very wary of getting involved in something like this. But they, you know, with the strong leadership of France and Britain, NATO has assumed total control of this. They got over Turkey's objections about actually controlling the part of this that attacks his armored forces, which is the most aggressive part so far. Surprisingly, I think that NATO has actually stepped up to the plate here and taken this operation. I will say on the CIA involvement, I would be willing to bet that a lot of those CIA guys are former Special Forces guys who just have retired and now joined the forces as the CIA's paramilitary arm. And what we found is in Afghanistan, especially in 2001, you really need guys on the ground when you're talking about armored forces that move around, not fixed sites like air defenses. When you have armored forces that are moving around and you have to distinguish between friend and foe, you really need boots on the ground to help that. And the British are not being very shy about saying their special air service guys, equivalent of our special forces, are on the ground, are lasing targets, are doing all the things that you see that the military does when it attaches our air power to an indigenous force.
So why did the rebels call for a ceasefire, David?
I think it's an early effort to signal to elements in the Gaddafi regime who might want to want to bail out, and there are more and more of them every day, it appears, that that this won't be a fight to the death if they're willing to make compromises. It's interesting that the White House, when you ask, where are we going on this, says, well, in the lead is going to be the United Nations, the contact group that's centered around the British and the French. And in particular, they point to the UN special envoy to Libya, who is a Jordanian diplomat. And his assignment right now, specifically, is to facilitate contacts between the rebels and elements of the government. So, you know, that's his job. It's something that I think is intended to take the air out of Gaddafi's fight to the death rhetoric. Just one more point to note. A part of this strategy is to cut off Gaddafi's access to money. This is a machine. Libyan regime is a machine that runs on cash. And people talk sometimes, oh, my gosh, we'll be there for years and years. If he doesn't have access to money to pay off the tribes, to pay off the retinue of supporters that he's had over the years, the machine isn't going to work.
Well, but if we're freezing that money, I mean, isn't he sort of caught between a rock and a hard place?
Well, that's the difference between how President Obama hopes to achieve regime change and how President Bush attempted to achieve regime change. When President Obama, as a candidate, analyzed what was wrong in his mind with Iraq, and we could spend the entire show talking about what went right and wrong, and mostly wrong in the early days of Iraq, he concluded that there were two big problems. One is there was no international participation, and the second was it was the U.S. seen as knocking off the leader. In this case, he wants to make sure it's the Libyan scene doing that.
David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Short break. We'll be right back. There are an awful lot of people concerned that we may be on a slippery slope in Libya, but we've got to move on now and talk about Syria. What did Syria's president have to say in a televised address to the nation, James Gitfield?
That all his problems are the result of foreign spies, and there's an Israeli connection. And it's the usual Middle East despot's argument for focusing internal unrest on the outside, trying to sort of get out from underneath the pressure. It didn't work. I mean, in the next day, he actually gave another speech where he says, well, I'm going to lift this 40 years of emergency rule, but we're going to do that only after I've reinstated some anti-terrorist laws. So he's totally muddling the message in a way that's not doing anything to tamp down really the objection of the protesters, which is that he's been around too long and he's been very repressive and they want him out.
David.
You know, what I find fascinating about Syria is the fact that we've been looking for the longest time for some form of common ground between the United States and Iran, and we might have finally found it in that the U.S. is not terribly eager to see the Syrian leadership upended. They still have hopes. I'm not entirely sure why that Syria would be part of a broader Mideast peace deal. And the Iranians certainly don't want to see Syria overturned. And in fact, I think Iran would have a lot more to lose if that happened. But it's this tells you what a strange moment we're at in the Middle East right now, that there is something on which Washington and Tehran have at least some commonality.
But David Ignatius, what chance is there that the Syrian government itself could fall?
Well, as we've seen, this is the season in which all bets are off. Predictions that you make about the durability of regimes tend to be shown to be wrong. What's fascinating about Syria, and this is acutely true now, but it's been true really since Bashar Assad came to power in the early part of the last decade, is that he has understood correctly that he needs to reform what is a corrupt, aging, inefficient country with a rotten to the core ruling Ba'ath Party. And yet, every time he goes up to the lip of that and making a decisive decision, he pulls back. And I've watched that. I've interviewed him a number of times. I'll just tell you, Diane, that when Bashar Assad talks privately, he gives an account of what's wrong that you and I would think is, you know, is pretty much spot on. He says the same thing to visitors like John Kerry and other Americans who go to see him. But it's in the nature of the Syrian regime, and in indeed in the nature of his family, which is sharply split. He has cousins who control the most corrupt businesses. He has half brothers who are in charge of the security forces. And so there's tremendous pressure on him not to make concessions. One final point that's really interesting, it goes a little bit against what David was saying a moment ago. I'm told that in the last few days, as Assad's been making these bizarre speeches after seeming to promise reforms, not doing anything, that one thing that's going on behind the scenes is intense pressure on him from Iran not to compromise, because the Iranians feel that if he gives ground, inevitably this wave will keep rolling, and it's going to roll toward Tehran.
James.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm not sure that we would miss Assad too much, but I take the point in all of these issues, and I think even more so in Yemen, it's what comes after Saleh in Yemen's case or after Assad in Syria's case that you have to worry about, and I don't think we have a good handle on that. But I do think that, you know, I was at a talk this week with an Israeli just retired as their head of intelligence, who was saying that, you know, the most hopeful thing here is this arc of radicalism that stretches from Tehran through Damascus to Hezbollah in Lebanon and to Hamas in the Gaza, that this could break that chain, that arc. And Syria is the weak link. It's secular. It's not an Islamist government. So I think there could be some hope here. And I'm sure that Iran is saying, you know, dig in your heels because we don't want this wave to be on our border.
And it's not just the wave. If Syria goes, Iran's way of moving arms, moving money, moving almost all of their tentacles out through the Middle East has a serious problem. And that's why I said, you know, I think the Iranians have a lot more to lose here than Washington does.
It's interesting that we also saw protests in Yemen, in Yemen's capital yesterday and today. What's happening there, James?
Well, I mean, it's looking Saleh's rule is looking very, very rickety right at this moment. His top right-hand man, the general, has just sort of defected after this horrible situation where snipers killed, you know, 40-plus demonstrators. General Amr, and it looks, there's been reports that he's talking about, you know, relinquishing power, and then he goes back on that. The problem with Yemen, though, is that this general is sort of an Islamist fundamentalist who's got ties to al-Qaeda. So, and there is a very strong strain of Islamic fundamentalism in Yemen. It's obviously the home of the most active al-Qaeda franchise, al-Qaeda in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. So we worry very much. I think that we would rather Saleh not fall. I think we would like to see some transition be built up so we would have a more orderly transition, because we worry a lot about what happens if Yemen falls into chaos.
David Ignatius.
I think Jim put it right in the phrase an orderly transition. I think there's an understanding in Washington that President Saleh has been in power too long, like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, that he's on the way out, that there have been defections from his inner circle, and this general Ali Mohsen is the most prominent example, but there are a number of others. Major tribes have been defecting, and Yemen is an especially tribal country. But the U.S. wants, because our counterterrorism interest in Yemen is so strong, we want to get to know the future government, the opposition, if you will, but the future government, as well as we can. And so
U.S.
officials have been...
But how do you do that?
Well, we've been working on this in truth for a year or so. There have been a range of contacts, talking with senior commanders of CENTCOM, the military arm that's responsible for us. Their focus has been on getting to know people in the army outside the president's circle, on getting to know civil society groups, on getting to know a range of politicians. I'm happy to say that in this case, they have known that the Saleh regime can't last. And so they've been trying to figure out who's on the other side of that divide. And we'll see over the next few months how well they did.
But there is something of a stalemate, isn't there, David Sanger?
There is. And I think that what you've heard David just describe about the U.S. effort to get to know these tribes is absolutely right. We see it. We saw it in the WikiLeaks cables when you went through these, at moments, hilarious conversations between General Petraeus and others and President Saleh, where the whole conversation was, we'll bomb al-Qaeda, you guys take credit for it. It was this effort to try to boost him up as a significant leader. I think the difference between when those cables were written and today is everyone in the administration has pretty well come to the conclusion that Saleh is out the door, and Saleh himself has said he's out in 3 years, and if he made it that far, I think we'd all think it was a miracle. this is a question of adjusting yourself to the inevitable.
All right, and there is a report this morning from the AP that Afghan officials say 8 people have been killed at a UN office in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif, where a Quran-burning protest turned violent. David?
Well, it's a dreadful report. It illustrates the way in which the Taliban is fighting back as we pound them. The New York Times has a very good report this morning by Carlotta Gall that says just what a beating the Taliban has been taking, how unsafe it is for Taliban commanders, how frustrated they are. But their response, as we've poured forces into their traditional strongholds in the south, has been to move into other areas. Mazar-e-Sharif, where this UN bombing took place, is in the north. It's in an area that hasn't traditionally been associated with the Taliban. And so this is a smart adversary. One other thing to say, things began to go really dark in Iraq when the UN compound was hit, and when the UN really wasn't able to operate in Iraq any longer. And if that happens in Afghanistan, if it becomes a no-go zone for anybody but armed U.S. And Afghan troops, it will be a much rougher place.
And go ahead.
I was just going to say that yesterday 6 U.S. troops died in Afghanistan as well, and on that border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think what we're seeing is this long anticipated spring offensive that General Petraeus has been warning about that it was going to pick up. We're starting to see it pick up already. The Taliban has been, as David says, has been hammered by our forces, but they have regrouped as they will in their sanctuaries in Pakistan, and I expect a bloody spring to come.
David Sanger.
Carlotta's piece this morning, I think, laid out very starkly that on a military scale, the surge has been successful, or at least is enjoying some successes, which is going to be an interesting point of debate as the administration heads into this question about how fast you begin to withdraw troops starting this summer. But that begs the question of whether or not the overall strategy, which was beat the Taliban militarily, they will then be willing to negotiate, is really the right theory. Because so far, at least from what we have seen in public and what you hear murmurings about, there isn't a serious negotiation that is underway. And it's very possible that, as David suggested, the Taliban theory right now is move north, move to the areas where the Americans aren't, and just wait for this troop withdrawal to begin.
And, of course, we cannot forget what's happening in the Ivory Coast with Mr. Gbagbo fighting, it would seem, to the death, David Ignatius.
He has been hunkered down ever since the November elections in which he lost and has been refusing to leave Abidjan, the capital of the Ivory Coast. The winner, Mr. Ouattara, and his forces are now, as of this morning, said to be in the capital, on the outskirts of the capital. And there's a sense that we're finally maybe reaching the end game. There have been defections from Gbagbo's own military command. And so, you know, we may be in the last hours of this. It is interesting to note the comparison between embattled rebels in Libya who get, you know, UN and international support, bingo, and embattled rebels in the Cote d'Ivoire who've been fighting this bloody battle since November.
They got a presidential message this morning.
Well, you know, that's a step up from what they had.
James.
Well, that's exactly right. And his top general, Philippe Mengu, defected this week, went to the South African embassy with his family. That was a huge blow. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine him holding out much longer. I will say, you know, as we talk about all these events around the region, it's a bad, bad week for despots. You know, if you look at Assad in Syria or Gaddafi in Libya or Saleh in Yemen or Gbagbo in Ivory Coast, this Arab Spring, whatever you want to call it, is having a really bad time for despots in that region.
And the only problem is we don't quite know what could come next. James Kitfield of National Journal, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you all about Japan and whether we are getting truthful statements from TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company. What's happening, James?
Well, what we know is happening is the radiation continues to leak and to spread in very worrisome ways. It's showing up, you know, they took a measure at the scene of some of the groundwater there, and it was 10,000 times above the legal limit. As far away as 25 miles away, you're seeing villages that have two times the legal limit of radiation. So it's spreading. And are we getting the straight shoot from the Japanese government? A lot of the Japanese don't think so.
The CEO of TEPCO ended up in the hospital.
Right.
They say that when Japanese officials have this kind of problem, they either commit suicide or they go into the hospital.
There is this reticence in their culture to lose face, and we've seen that, you know, in many instances, and that causes people to wonder whether people are actually being honest. Now, I have a lot of empathy for the Japanese government. They have just confronted one of the worst disasters we've ever seen. You know, a triple disaster with the earthquake, the tsunami, and now this disaster at their reactor complex. So I'm sympathetic, but they're clearly not handling this in a way that's inspiring a lot of confidence
and
in their own
there
people.
There is some concern about milk now and radiation showing up in milk.
There have been unacceptable levels detected in milk. One new worry is that cesium has been found in the area surrounding this plant.
Tell me what cesium is.
I'm no physicist, but it's an element that basically takes forever to decompose. It's not like radiation. It doesn't disperse quickly, and so there's a danger if cesium has been released, it goes into the groundwater and persists. So you can get whole areas if they're contaminated with cesium that are essentially uninhabitable for a long time.
David Tanger.
Well, the good news about the cesium, if there is any good news here, is it's a very heavy element, so it hasn't been found that far from the plant. The iodine, the radioactive iodine 131, which has made its way into the milk, has gone much further, but has a much shorter half-life, just about 8 days. Let me go back to your TEPCO question. I lived in Japan for 6 years and dealt with TEPCO regularly because they were bringing in some of the mixed oxide fuels that we're now worried about for these plants. They are not a utility that is you would initially think of as the most transparent operation on Earth, even in the best of times. So the freezing up that you've seen happen here did not surprise me. And I have a lot of friends in the Japanese government who believe that they have not been told the straight story by TEPCO. Now, that said, several of the reactor buildings are so radioactive on the inside that TEPCO workers, who quite heroically have been going in, can't get in or stay in for long enough. So what do we know right now? We believe that at least one of the four reactors had a 70% meltdown or damage to the core. That's probably where much of the cesium and that we're seeing come out is coming from. The good news is they've cooled down a lot. It's 3 weeks today from the beginning of the accident, and so some radioactive decay has just sort of set in. The other thing we were very concerned about were the spent fuel rods, which were stored in each of these sites. And in those cases, it looks like most of those are covered now, and the temperature data I've seen on those in recent days has been pretty good. So we may be getting toward the end.
David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. When we come back, we'll open the phones for your calls. Take your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing possibilities in hemophilia and supporting World Hemophilia Day at changingpossibilities-us.com. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by LendingTree, providing multiple loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. This is NPR.
Season 4 of Mad Men has just come out on DVD, but Season 5 has been pushed back to 2012. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with John Hamm, the star of the series. And David Mitchell talks about his best-selling novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which has just been published in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. It's time to open the phones first to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, yes. How you doing, ma'am?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to say I'm glad there was somebody on your panel to debunk this whole notion that Bush in Iraq is the same thing as Obama in Libya, because it's not the same. And also, as you recall, 3 weeks ago, 3 to 4 weeks ago, when Gaddafi was marching towards Benghazi, everyone was asking, where was the president? Where's the president? Where's the president? The president got everybody together, international coalition, got everybody together, and went in and did the no-fly zone. And then now he's receiving all this criticism. You got the progressives who feel that you can talk dictators like Gaddafi down, and then you got the ones who were hawks. Now they're acting like doves. So I'm trying to figure out what's the problem. Benghazi has 700,000 individuals there. So are we going to risk having a massacre of 100,000? And then what happens then? He gets the criticism.
All right, James Kitfield.
Well, he raises a good point. If you take a middle ground on a military intervention, you're going to get criticized from both the left and the right,
sure.
And that certainly has happened here. I will say that, and he's accomplished a lot of multilateral bars he's jumped over with the Arab League and then with the UN Security Council and then with NATO taking control. So kudos there. He's done it in a very reluctant way, though, that people are not used to seeing U.S. leadership. If you recall, we started this military operation on the eve of a trip of his to Latin America. He wasn't around to answer questions about this. We didn't even hear from the president for 9 days. And he has to describe this situation where we intervened for a humanitarian, to avert a humanitarian disaster. However, we're not willing to go much further, even though we would kind of like Gaddafi to leave. It's a fairly muddled message. So I think there is some criticism about the way he's done it.
Here's an email from Mark on Moussa Koussa, the Libyan defector. He says you described him as being in talks with the British. What a revolting thought. This man is a mass murderer, directly responsible for the deaths of more than 200 on Pan Am 103. Will he be given millions and a nice house in the country, or will he be convicted and shot, as he should have been 20 years ago? David Ignatius.
I think the listener is right in describing Moussa Koussa as a killer. He ran Gaddafi's intelligence service for decades. His fingerprints are on every dirty thing that regime has done. He is a smooth killer. He is a very polished man, very American, has charmed many of the people he's dealt with. The British say that he won't be given immunity for any of these crimes, even though he's defected. And I must say his defection is the most important weakening of the Gaddafi regime. I don't believe it. I don't believe that he didn't cut a deal. Moussa Koussa is too smart and smooth a guy not to make his best deal coming out.
Do you agree, David Sanger?
I'm sure he tried to cut a deal, and maybe he managed to do so with the British. I think there's a good chance that an international court could well indict him. His connections to Pan Am 103 are supposed to be quite deep, but that was not, by a long shot, the only crime that I think he can well be charged with. The British are in politically a difficult spot here, because having sent back the one convicted bomber who allegedly was suffering from a terminal disease and then seemed to recover quite nicely by the time he miraculously, yes, by the time he arrived in Tripoli. I don't think any British government right now could afford to treat Moussa Koussa terribly liberally.
Fool me once and not twice, James.
I kind of agree with that. I mean, I'm sure David's right. Why would he defect if he thought he was going to be end up, charged with all these crimes? However, it's going to be very tough for Britain to sort of support this guy in exile. And I do recall that Slobodan Milosevic cut a deal with Richard Holbrooke and ended up at the criminal court in The Hague, where he died. So I don't think this guy's out of the woods.
I think it's a unpleasant reality that to settle conflicts like this, you end up having to make deals with people that you abhor. That's
right.
How wars end, and that's how this one's going
to
end.
All right. To Clearwater, Florida. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning, Diane. My concern is this. Actually, I think even though the United States is, along with allied forces, my belief is that it was a bad move on the United States. My reasoning is this. We are concurrently fighting two wars, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. And as far as I'm concerned, our military is exhausted. I'm wondering where we are getting the funds to fight another war. And it also troubles me, as other nations and also those nations in the Middle East see the United States as being meddlesome.
She raises an interesting point, exactly all the points that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates raised about in his concern about this. And the thing that, to answer her last question, was the thing that got him over the line in support of this, which was the Arab League had done something that it had never done before, asked for a foreign intervention to depose of, basically, or against one of its own rulers, of a member of the Arab League, Libya. So I think at that moment, and after the UN Security Council resolution passed, which the Obama administration did not twist anyone's arm to get over reluctance of the Russians, the Chinese, who abstained. I think they were stuck in a position where it was going to be them standing against an intervention that could have that could facilitate a massacre. You know, Bill Clinton, and I'm sure Hillary Clinton's been a supporter of intervening here. She recalls being in the White House where we stood by and didn't even let the UN stop the slaughter in Rwanda. And that was, as President Clinton has said, he thought that was his worst mistake. So I'm sure he was getting advice that, you know, there's no good choice here left. He chose to intervene.
David Ignatius, how many of the nations of the Arab League agreed to the no-fly zone?
I only know that it was a majority. There were some who dissented. There has been a defection from the Arab League consensus since the action started. I mean, people got cold feet when they saw U.S. planes operating in the air. I was in Egypt with Secretary Gates last week, and I'll never forget a young Egyptian journalist standing up and asking Secretary Gates, why is America attacking another Arab country? This is Iraq again. So I think there's a deep anxiety. I think the Saudis in particular are unhappy with what the U.S. is doing. That said, Qatar is going to host the next meeting of the contact group. There are Qatari planes in the air, and there are said to be UAE planes on the way.
David Sanger.
You know, your caller raised all the right questions, and as James said, the questions that Secretary Gates was raising. There was another side to this debate in the White House, though, which was if the United States stayed out, particularly after the Arab League made this statement, what message does that send elsewhere in the region, that the U.S. would never commit forces on the side of the rebel groups or to depose despots? Particularly, what message would it have sent to the Iranians, who are constantly measuring and testing Barack Obama to figure out, when he says that the United States is not going to let Iran get a bomb, does he really mean it?
To Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Hi there, Paul.
Good morning, Diane, and your guests. Back to the same question you brought up. My understanding, the Arab League met once to make this discussion, and they only had 11 members out of 22 that were in the meeting. And only 7 out of that 11 voted to have this no-fly zone. My question is, how is 7 out of 22 considered the Arab League?
James.
I don't believe that's correct. As I recall, it was a vast majority. In fact, I only remember Syria being the one vote no. I thought it was a vast majority of the Arab League. Now, whether they were all present in the room, they all sent emissaries and let their vote be known. I don't think it was just 7.
David Ignatius.
Paul has details that I don't about this. There was a formal decision by the Arab League with whatever numbers that supported this, was linked to the UN actions specifically referenced. I think the point to note is that since that vote, there have been countries that appeared to be supportive that have been pulling back.
All right. To Fort Worth, Texas, and to Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. My question is, how will the president's ability to galvanize international support for the no-fly zone and the good news with the job reports affect his approval rating?
Well, there was a great job report today. The jobless rate, I think, falling to 8.8%. That's going to make the White House very happy. This is a trial-and-error presidency, and I'm struck as I watch Obama how he gets it wrong the first time, maybe gets it wrong the second time, but it gets better. I thought his Libya speech was a pretty coherent explanation of what he was doing. You could disagree with it, but the president laid forth the reasons why he did what he did, why he's not going to do more, why it would have been a mistake to do less. I think he can argue that his economic policies that have attacked are finally beginning to show some fruit. So this is a week in which I would think the president would say, it's going pretty well.
David Sanger.
You know, what strikes me about this presidency, and I think David's phrase of trial and error is absolutely right, is I think this is an incredibly pragmatic presidency. I can't remember since I ended my days as a foreign correspondent and came back to Washington of seeing less ideology in the Oval Office than I do today. And I know that is a controversial view, and there are some on the right who call President Obama a socialist, and there are some on the left who question whether he is going off in the direction of George W. Bush. I actually think that when you look at both what they did on the economic side and what they're doing in the Middle East, their insistence this past week that there wasn't really a doctrine out of this speech, it was country by country, I think that's their way of trying to convey the thought that he is groping his way in extraordinarily pragmatic form. And I actually think that's probably the case from what we recreate out of the discussions.
James.
I think that's right. And David says it's a trial and error presidency. But what trials this presidency has had? It's unbelievable, really, the amount of crises that he's had to confront, you know, just in the first couple of years of his presidency. And I think one of our reporters, Ron Brownstein, wrote this, that he most seems like Eisenhower to a lot of people. He's very pragmatic. He doesn't have a, you know, there was a comment made that this wasn't an Obama doctrine because Obama's not doctrinaire. And I think that's exactly right. He's a pragmatist.
What did you make of John McCain's criticism of the president's decision to go into Libya, even with his no-fly zone, comparing it to Vietnam?
My understanding of John McCain's position was he was pushing Obama to go in and go in hard, not just with a no-fly, but go in and basically act as the air power for the rebels. McCain and Lieberman have been leaning way forward, I think, on this one. I'm not sure who made the Vietnam analogy, but I don't think it was McCain.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. JC, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning,
kudos
sir.
To your panel.
Thank
kudos
you.
Kudos to your panel. You always have the best.
I sure do. Thank you.
Yes, you do. I have a question about Japan's nuclear crisis over there. Here in America, we're freaking out and popping our iodide pills, and we don't ever hear anything about what China or Korea or Vietnam or any of the Eastern countries are reacting, how they're reacting to this problem over there. Can any of your panel address that?
David Sanger.
Well, you have seen the Chinese, and I believe the Koreans, so I have to go back and refresh my memory on this, begin to impose some restrictions on the import of food that is right around that plant or in the prefectures that are right near it. What they have been blessed by is that the winds, by and large, have been moving the other direction, out to the Pacific. So by the time they've hit the United States, the levels have been trace levels that you can barely read above normal background radiation. If the wind shifted, if you began to see significant accumulation of radioactive materials detected in either China or Korea, given the long and ugly history between those countries and Japan, I suspect you'd see a much bigger political issue.
James.
I think I read that China basically turned back a Japanese ship full of automobiles because they were worried that they had levels of radiation, which gets at something that we haven't even come to grips with, which is what is the economic long-term impact of this? I don't know if Americans are going to want to buy a lot of Japanese cars until they understand what sort of radiation exposures there's been. So I think there's a fair amount of nervousness in Asia over this.
Dave.
Well, a lot of the Japanese cars, of course, are made in the U.S. now. The question that I'm intrigued by is whether this incredibly traumatic experience will in some ways change the political culture of Japan, that David Sanger, who really knows this subject, was referring to earlier. Japanese must be shaken not simply by this catastrophic event, but by the way in which their culture of reticence has often suppressed the truth, and so people haven't really known what's going on. And I keep waiting for Japan to become more modern as a political culture. Maybe this will be a trigger for that.
Do you think?
You know, people have often hoped for that, and I suspect that we will see some marginal changes. But if you go back and you read the histories of the last year or two of World War II in Japan, again, the people were kept largely in the dark about how bad the news was, which is why the emperor, it was such a shock when the emperor came on the radio and said what he said on the days just around the surrender. And, you know, every history that you read of Japan since the Meiji Restoration has always got an introduction. I've got one on my shelves from the 1880s talking about how a new younger generation of Japanese are going to be, you know, far more open than the previous one. I think that is happening and has happened, but it happens at a pace that we would consider glacial given our society. What's different in this case is that you've had internet reports that are going abroad and then coming back into Japan, and you've got, you know, a young population that's reading all that.
Last word, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine. David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post, co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. Thanks for listening, all. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.